Yeah, so I'm going to talk about some work I've been doing with Matt Lewandowski and Leonardo Sanatori at Stanford. Most of it's focused on adding variance to the effective field theory of large scale structure, but I'll also talk a little bit about work we're doing on BMODs. So the motivation for this talk is there are a few observables that we can still hope to observe that will tell us something about inflation. And two of these are the tensor to scalar ratio R and FNL, the level of scalar non-Gaussianity. So the constraints for Planck only restrict FNL within about like 5 to 20, depending on the shape. And we don't expect these constraints to get much better because Planck is cosmic variance limited up to the silk damping scale where we can't get any primordial information. So, and this is a problem because in order to say something really conclusive about slow roll inflation, we need to get to the level of FNL less than one, because at that point, even a null detection would tell us that the mass scale suppressing the higher order, the higher derivative corrections to the effective field theory of inflation is large, and we essentially have slow roll inflation. So if we want to get to the level of FNL less than one, we'll have to do something different. So for FNL, I'll be talking about large scale structure, but first I'll talk a little bit about R. The excitement about B-modes was the fact that they were thought to be sort of a smoking gun for inflation, that if we detected any B-modes, then that would in some sense prove inflation because no other theory could produce them. However, this is not a theorem. It's true that it's difficult to produce tensor modes in non-inflationary backgrounds, but there's no no-go theorem. So it'd be nice to sort of make this more precise. There's an argument along these lines for the scalars that inflation is the only single field model that can produce scale invariant scalar modes. And it'd be nice to extend this argument to the tensors as well.
That's it.
Yep.
There are lots of other models that produce scalar invariant scalar modes.
Yeah.
In the literature.
Yes, but this is the only single field model. Single field.
It's a matter of opinion.
Well, no, I mean, if there's one light scalar field, then it's incorporated in the EFT of inflation.
Single field. So you're talking specifically about inflation.
No, I mean, so if you have a non-inflationary background, then it's the only scalar field. It has a non-scale invariant power spectrum. So in order to look at backgrounds that are non-inflationary, we're going to take a scaling ansatz that goes like t to some power alpha, which is a constant. And that means that the Hubble parameter goes like alpha over t. And regardless of what background we're studying, we need it to solve the horizon problem in order for it to account for the large scale correlations in the CMB. And this means that the physical wave number k over a divided by the size of the horizon h has to decrease with time so that the modes are pushed out of the horizon and they can later re-enter and we can see them in the CMB as super horizon correlations. In these models, we can define a so-called slow roll parameter, h dot over h squared, which is a constant here, 1 over alpha. And you can see that in the limit alpha goes to 0, alpha goes to infinity, that the slow roll parameter is exactly 0. And that's the limit of exacta sitter. So large alpha corresponds to inflation. But since alpha is generic, this is not necessarily a small parameter. When we consider which backgrounds solve the horizon problem, we find three different classes of solutions depending on the value of alpha. So the first class is a Big Bang-like solution, which expands from a small size with a nearly constant Hubble rate that decreases with time. And this is the class that approaches inflation in the limit of large alpha, which you can see that the power law becomes more and more exponential-like, and the Hubble becomes flatter and flatter and more constant. The second class of solutions are the contracting ones. These have fractional alpha. And this approaches the limit of ekpyrosis when alpha goes to zero. A final class of solutions has alpha less than zero. These are exotic solutions because they violate the null energy condition and the Hubble rate increases with time. But they have a similar scaling expansion. Okay, so we know that the epoch that solves the horizon problem has to end at some point so that the modes re-enter the horizon. And this means that in order to describe these perturbations, we just need to write down the most generic theory that describes a background that spontaneously breaks time translation invariance. And this turns out to be the EFQ of inflation. And it's a bit confusing that we can use the EFT of inflation to describe non-inflationary solutions, but that's just sort of an unfortunate nomenclature because it really could be termed the EFT of FRW because it describes any smooth FRW background that eventually ends. So in the EFT of inflation, we write down all terms, all gravitational terms that are allowed by the unbroken symmetry, which is time-dependent spatial diffeomorphisms, which includes terms in the curvature, the terms that depend on the 0-0 component of the metric, as well as extrinsic curvature terms, which are just the curvature of the embedding of the spatial slice in time.
So what is the cutoff of the EFT that you're writing?
So it depends on the couplings that you have.
So usually you have a systematic expansion in something, and my understanding was that if you have inflation, it was in a slower parameter. But then I guess if you're not doing inflation, then what is this? You're just writing all possible terms?
But there's a finite number at each derivative order.
Okay.
It's a derivative expansion.
Okay, so it's a derivative expansion. But it's so that the derivatives must be much smaller than some scale?
Yeah.
Okay. It's not that, okay.
In other words, is the ordering of the terms, when you affected field theory, FRW, but then when you decide how to order terms order by order and treat some more important than the others, then implicitly the idea of the whole constant is slowly varying, slowly decreasing.
No, even in the inflation case, it's a derivative expansion, and the only effect of the slow roll is that terms are even more suppressed with respect to the derivative expansion. So you get more terms, but not parametrically more. And you can do sort of different expansions, such as like the large roll expansion of alpha. Alpha
small. Why couldn't it have like some arbitrary function of density not there?
Because that would be higher order derivatives.
The density not that doesn't have any derivatives. So I guess maybe I don't understand the counting yet. So how do you find the derivative?
So delta G 0-0 goes like delta N, which goes like zeta dot.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's wonderful.
Yeah, so all of these linear terms are fixed by the background Einstein equations. And then higher order terms have generic time-dependent coefficients. So if we only have the background terms, then the two-point function of the tensors is just given by h squared over m Planck squared, which is clearly not scale invariant if h is strongly time-dependent. But we can attempt to fix this by adding a speed of sound to the tensors using this extrinsic curvature term. And in this case, the speed of sound goes like h squared over the tensor two-point function goes like h squared over the speed of sound, and we can hope to restore scale invariance of the perturbations.
What do you mean? Shouldn't there be a C gamma squared in the bullet point above the equation?
Where?
In the bullet point above the equation. Shouldn't the C gamma be squared?
No, that's because the normalization of, so it's 1 over C gamma squared in the canonically normalized field, but then when you go back to, when you go to a Fourier space, there's a K cubed over omega that gives you another factor.
What is theta?
It's whatever function of time appears in front of this coefficient.
It's just a parameter.
It's the speed of sound for, I guess, for the stellar motion.
Yeah, it's the sound of the speed of propagation of the modes,
yeah,
of the tensor modes. This doesn't give a speed of sound to the scalars. So we can parameterize this speed of sound as a scaling solution with constant exponent m, and then we can solve the equation for the tensor modes at first order. When we go to these rescaled time coordinates of dy goes like c gamma over a dt, then we find this simple action, which is the canonical one, multiplied by this time-dependent prefactor that goes like this constant n, which depends on both the background and the speed of sound parameters. Since this is a simple scaling ansatz, we can solve this analytically, and the solutions are Hankel functions, which we know are scale invariant if this exponent is equal to minus 1. So that means that we can impose that the solutions are scale invariant if we choose this particular scaling for the speed of sound. C goes like t to the minus 2.
So going back to the question about the derivative expansion,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you go back to the slides where you showed that, yeah. So if supposing you broke a point where C was very small, so that means the coefficient in front of the delta k terms is getting very large. Is that going to be a threat to your expansion?
Yes, exactly. That's going to be the problem of why we're not going to be able to fix this with the speed of sound is as naively as we expect.
Okay,
so yeah, that's a good point. So we found that we could fix the speed of sound uniquely in terms of a constant, which is kind of strange because it was independent of the background. So that seems like by choosing the speed of sound, we can have any arbitrary background and get scale invariant solutions. However, this is not the full story because the term that we added to the action is nonlinear in the fluctuations. So we get a contribution to the quadratic action, but we also get contribution to higher order terms with fixed coefficients that we can't change to try to cancel out. and since this CF is very rapidly time dependent, we can relate the change over this epoch that we're concerned with in terms of the number of modes that go outside of the horizon, e to the n. And we find that the speed of sound changes by an exponential amount in the number of modes, modulo this factor of the background. We also know that in order for the tensors to propagate with a speed lower than the speed of light, then they have to be less than, the speed of sound has to be less than 1 at all points in time. And we don't want to allow superluminal propagation. So we know that if the speed of sound always is less than 1, then at some point it is exponentially small. The problem is that as it was pointed out, that the speed of sound as it goes to 0 becomes a large coefficient of the terms in the action. And there's a term in the cubic action that goes like 1 over c gamma squared. And so when compared to the quadratic action, it becomes large. And in order for this expansion to be valid, the higher order terms have to be parametrically smaller than the lower order terms. So we have to require that this ratio is much less than 1. And that requirement puts a lower limit on the speed of sound of the tensors. In terms of the tensorless scalar ratio, which comes from the factor of the two-point function, and the background alpha. So given the fact that we've seen that the speed of sound has to be exponentially small, but also has a lower bound, we get a bound of the number of e-foldings in terms of the tensor to scalar ratio and the background parameter alpha. And looking at this bound, we can take a few interesting limits. One is in the limit that alpha goes to infinity, which is the sitter. We find that it's easily satisfied because the left-hand side is small and the right-hand side is large. And this is good because we know that the sitter has an arbitrary number of scale invariant e-foldings. Another interesting limit is the Ekpyrosis limit, alpha much less than 1. And you find that in order for this to be satisfied, you have to have a non-perturbatively small r, because of this r, this 1/10 log r over alpha term, which is certainly not included in perturbation theory. So this is not allowed perturbatively, and you'd have to go to some UV model. In order to make some sort of quantitative constraints on the approach to inflation, we can say that we want to have an observable number, an observable level of tensor modes, say greater than 10 to the minus 6, say for 10 e-foldings. And for these parameters, you would need to have alpha. This limit says that you need to have alpha greater than 4, which corresponds to a epsilon, the slow roll parameter less than 1/4, which is essentially inflation. So this limit tells you how many e-foldings of scale invariant perturbations you can have. And in order to have a significant number for a large enough tensor to scalar ratio, you have to have scale inflation-like backgrounds.
I'll say the field inflation of r divided by n sub t is equal to minus 8.
R divided by?
R divided by n sub t is mm-hmm. minus 8. It's consistency coefficient. Mm-hmm. It's true whatever the tension we use.
In?
It's called the consistency coefficient.
Sure.
A single field. Mm-hmm.
What's the question?
Yeah.
The question is, how does that fit into these numbers? At the end, single-field inflation.
This just gives a bound on the number of e-folding. So that equality doesn't tell you how many e-foldings you can have. So the story is a little more complicated than a simple case, because I've not talked about the neck-violating backgrounds. These have to be treated separately because in the case of neck violation, the perturbations generically are ghosts and have energy unbounded from below. So we have to add higher derivative corrections in order to stabilize the ghost. And these produce more parameters that affect the limits that we have. We're also looking into particle production mechanisms in non-scale invariant backgrounds. So it was shown that it's possible to have B modes from classical gravitational waves during a de Sitter epoch. So we were wondering whether we could also have B modes from this process during a non-de Sitter epoch. And there are similar constraints on strong coupling of the background, even though these tensors are not directly produced by the background. So this is work in progress with Leonardo. And now to the main topic, which is large-scale structure. So since we want to find a FNL less than 1, we're looking to future probes of the primordial cosmological parameters, which include large-scale structure surveys. And projections for large-scale structure are promising. They indicate that we could get to the level of FNL of 3, which is competitive with Planck. But if we want to get limits better than Planck, then we have to do better. But these projections are naive projections based on the linear modes. So we can do better with our analysis if we go into the nonlinear regime analytically. So in order to describe the nonlinear regime of large-scale structure, we're going to write an effective field theory for it, which describes the long modes, the effect of the very nonlinear modes on the modes that we're concerned with by integrating them out. The advantages of using an EFT in general are that since it's an approximation of the full theory at low energies, it's often simpler than the full theory.
Sorry,
yep.
Can I interrupt you for a second? So, I guess the question is lingering on my mind from last part.
Mm-hmm.
So, if you're not doing effective field theory of inflation, but effective field theory in FRW, so you do need the derivative expansion, but what guarantees that you're not above the cutoff of other? What guarantees that the derivative expansion is valid?
So, you determine the cutoff of the theory
okay. As
the point where the perturbation
goes
down.
So it could be that it's never valid.
Yeah, but I think there's always the regime of parameter space where it is valid.
Doesn't that depend? Well, okay, so there could be some error that it is valid and some error that it's not valid. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so EFTs are simpler than the full theory, and they parameterize the effect of the UV modes that we're not concerned with on the modes that we are concerned with, plus perturbative corrections that tell us the level of approximation that we've left out. So in the case of the effective field theory for large-scale structure, our UV theory is just the Boltzmann equation for collisionless dark matter particles in a Newtonian potential. And our IR theory, after we integrate out the short-scale modes, will turn out to be an effective gravitational fluid. In this case, since the theory of the dark matter particles is known, in principle, you can do this integrating out exactly and calculate the coefficients of the effective field theory from the UV parameters. And this has been done and compared to small-scale simulations. But it since the UV dynamics is generally complicated, it turns out to be easier to use the bottom-up approach where we don't presume to know the high energy theory. And we just write a generic stress tensor that has all possible terms allowed by symmetry. And in this case, the parameters are not fixed, and we have to match them to observations. And once we match at a certain value of k, then we can predict all other values of k through the theory because these are constants. So for the construction of the EFT of large-scale structure, I'll talk about how it works for dark matter first and then add the baryons later. So we simply have a theory of the phase space density of particles in a box with given a position and momentum. And they obey the Boltzmann equation, which includes a gravitational interaction between each particle. Because a particle only feels a gravitational force from particles that are not it.
So this Fn isn't that just the phase space density? So you're defining it for a single particle?
Yeah, this is a single particle phase space density.
How could a single particle have a phase space density?
Well, I mean, in terms of delta function.
You're summing over n.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, this is probably a typo. That's the total n. So the n particle of phase space density is the thing inside the sum.
Okay. Well, I guess that's not how usually Boltzmann equation is.
Yeah, you can write it in terms of the normal bulk Boltzmann equation and write the single particle phase space density where you integrate over all the other modes. And it's a similar picture, but this is just, since we have discrete particles, it's a nice picture. Since we want to integrate out the small scale modes, we apply a window function that cuts off all momenta greater than some cutoff lambda. And then we expand the phase space density in moments, which gives us fluid equations for the density and the velocity of the fluid, which are defined as the first and second moments of the phase space density. So this is an approach that is usually taken when we're describing fluids. But you might ask why a fluid approximation is valid here. And that's because the higher moments that we are not considering are suppressed by derivatives. And this is a valid approximation to neglect them if we're concerned with length scales that are longer than the typical path of the particles, the UV particles interacting. So that means as long as we're looking at modes greater than the nonlinear scale, then we can use this approximation. This differs a little bit from a normal fluid because in a normal fluid, the mean free path is provided by the particles bouncing into each other and interacting. And here, the mean free path does not come from interactions, but it comes from the gravitational potential. Dark matter does not self-interact, but since it moves non-relativistically, then it is only able to move a short distance in time scale, the cosmological times of interest. So it has an effective mean free path that goes like its velocity over the Hubble rate. So when we write down the fluid equations, we get these two equations, the Euler equation of number density conservation for the density and momentum, and the momentum equation, which is sourced by an effective stress tensor that comes from the smooth gravitational interaction. Since we've integrated out the short scale modes, the effective stress tensor is only a function of the long modes. And since we're only concerned with large distances, we can do a derivative expansion in K over K nonlinear. And so when we write down all terms that are allowed by symmetry, which are simply rotations and translations, we get a stress tensor of this form in terms of the density, the divergence of velocity, the vorticity, plus higher order terms that are quadratic or higher in the long field, plus a term that does not depend on the long wavelength fields, which is the stochastic stress, which arises from the fact that in every patch that we integrate out, the constant value of the stress tensor is not necessarily the average one of all the patches, but it's some random realization of the probability distribution. So we expect this to be a random variable that is uncorrelated with the long wavelength fields. And all of these terms that we wrote down have undetermined parameters, which encode the effect of the short wavelength modes on the long modes. And since they have information about the UV theory, we can't predict them in the effective field theory. They have to be fit to the data.
So the argument for the delta tau is that you're first writing in those kind of fluctuations in the short physics that you're
writing
over. And the C's, the C1, C2, C3, you're also parameterizing short distance physics. Why aren't they stochastic variables too?
For
the same reason.
Well, you could just put all of them in delta tau, I'd say.
Is that what you do?
I guess it's up to you. Whatever that doesn't fit in there, you can put. I think that's the way it's done.
I was wondering if there's a general argument as to why it's added to this fluctuation.
So, So the, I mean, so my intuition is that you just have the expectation value of short modes in the background of a long mode, which is just gives you a number. But so you're asking if that could give you a stochastic term as well?
I'm just, I might not have understood the argument for Delta-Tau very well, but I thought that the idea there was that you're, you know, if I take different patches around the sky, mm-hmm. different realizations, so they could have different properties at some level. And the fluctuations in that is what Delta-Tau tracks. But in the same sense, if the seas are capturing coarse grain physics, it's something they could also look very around the sky. And also, I don't see why they would be representation specific the way that the Tau was. I can ask you afterwards.
Yeah, I haven't thought about that, but that's a good question. So we've written all terms at first order that we can write, and they're functions of both the density and the velocity, but the linear equations relate the density and the velocity. So if we're only concerned with one loop terms, they're degenerate. So at one loop, we simply have one speed of sound parameter multiplying the divergence of the density plus two derivatives on this stochastic term. And since the stochastic term is only correlated with itself, it will end up with four derivatives in the power spectrum and will be highly suppressed in the derivative expansion. And we can turn out to neglect it, but it will be important at higher loop order. So now that we have our theory.
So, so what actually makes delta tau idea to be only correlated with itself? Couldn't be correlated.
Because we've extracted the dependence on the long wave fields in the other parameters.
I mean, can you do that? Because I mean, I think all that you say is not that true. Okay, so maybe that's what constructive
messy. Yeah.
So the definition of delta tau
idea. Yeah. Okay, so now we can proceed with perturbation theory by expanding the density in perturbations. So the linear term is given by solving the linear equations of motion, and then higher order terms are given by convolving this linear term with the Green's function and propagating forward in time. And then the terms that are second order in perturbations, you have a vertex that couples two linear perturbations, involves them in time with the Green function to the second order solution, and similarly for the third order term. So we can organize this in a diagrammatic expansion, where these are the expressions for the fluctuations. And then what the observables are correlation functions. So for the two-point function, you correlate these modes. And since the linear power spectrum is randomly distributed, it only has correlation functions with itself. And that means, as usual, you have to contract two x's to form a propagator. And when you expand out to one loop order in perturbation theory, you get these four terms, the linear power spectrum, plus the one loop term that comes from two delta twos, plus the one loop term that comes from a delta three and a delta one, and then finally a counter term, which is just proportional to k squared times the speed of sound times the linear power spectrum. So the function of this counter term is to cancel the dependence of the smooth fields on our regulator lambda. So since we chose an arbitrary smoothing scale, physical observables should not depend on it. So all the dependence of the loops and the linear power spectra are canceled by the dependence of this counter term by construction. And the counter term also has some finite terms that are not dependent on the smoothing scale, which also contribute to the evolution. So when we solve these equations of motion, including counter terms, and match to numerical simulations, we get very good agreement. So The purple solid line is linear theory. The red line is one loop EFT. The blue line is two loop EFT. And these dashed lines are the theory without counter terms. And this is what was done before the EFT approach. And you can see that without including counter terms, the theory is not convergent. So it's really only consistent to include the counter terms. So now we're going to add baryons to this picture. So you might wonder why you need to add baryons, because they form a small fraction of the matter density in the universe. And indeed, until recently, most numerical simulations have been dark matter only. But it hasn't shown in simulations that baryon processes do affect the total matter power spectrum on the scales we're interested in by more than 1%. And this is a problem because baryon effects are very complicated to simulate. They include star formation effects, supernova feedback, active galactic nuclei that expel dust from the galaxy. So including these effects in a simulation requires very, very detailed simulation on small scales to get the star formation right, while also having a large dynamic range of simulating cosmological scales. So it'd be nice to be able to treat these effects analytically. You might ask, since these effects are so complicated, why would we expect the baryons to also behave as an effective fluid? And they seem to act differently because they have pressure, they explode, they stream out of stars. So why can they still be thought of as an effective fluid? And this is because similar to the dark matter, the baryons are very non-relativistic, even when they're hot and expelled from the galaxy. So the mass density lost at the smoothing scale is small, and the amount that they're able to move in a Hubble time is small compared to the Hubble radius. So the effect of these complex baryon processes are effectively within the smoothing scale and just provide a new source of these counterterm coefficients.
So I should probably comment. The last sentence says in a cluster, baryons and dark matter are quite the same region, but your picture says otherwise.
Yeah. So I meant pyramid. Yeah. So order one, the same regions.
Right. Usually, that picture is used to argue against that.
Yeah. So people argue like, oh, baryons are explode out and they're so different from dark matter, but when we're zooming out to cosmological scales, we don't really care. That looks the same to us.
You're showing the picture.
Huh?
You were showing the picture.
Yeah.
Contradicts the last thing.
Yes, I'm sorry.
For the train wreck cluster, 8520, there's no evidence that there is a dark matter peak at the center of the cluster.
What do you mean?
It's causing trouble.
Oh, yeah.
So the whole thing about clusters merging is problematic at this point.
Yeah. Well, our approach doesn't care about the detailed effects of these tail effects.
Clusters is not a ordinary cluster. Yeah.
Okay, so including the baryons in the fluid approach is pretty simple. We just modify the equations to have two particle species interacting only through gravity, which means that we essentially have two copies of our fluid equations that are coupled only through this potential term that is proportional to both the baryon and the dark matter density. And these come in terms of their relative densities, WB for the dark matter and WC for the WB for the baryons and WC for the dark matter. One final difference with the one fluid case is in the counter terms of the momentum equation. And in these, we have the normal effective stress tensor that comes from the smoothing. But since momentum is no longer conserved for each fluid separately because the gravitational potential exchanges momentum, then we have a term that accounts for the fact that there's not conservation for each fluid that has one fewer derivative because it's not conserved. And these two terms have to be equal and opposite, so they cancel in the total matter power spectrum. So the total matter power spectrum has a conserved stress tensor. So similarly to the approach that we had for one fluid, we're going to expand the right-hand side in terms of a derivative expansion of long wavelength fields. Again, we're at one loop, so we can relate the velocities to the densities. So we only have to write densities here. And we have two types of terms. The first is a gravitationally induced speed of sound, which is proportional to this combination of the densities, which is the part that sources the gravitational potential. We also have a part that comes from the fact that the velocity of, say, the baryon particles redistributes the baryons and affects the back reacts on the density. So we have a part that is proportional to the baryons alone that is due to the velocity. And similarly for the dark matter. Now, since we're usually interested in the total matter power, it's convenient to change the basis to a basis of adiabatic and isocurvature modes, where adiabatic is just the total matter and isocurvature is the relative density. And you see from the linear equations of motion for these two fields that the isocurvature mode, the growing mode, is actually a constant, in contrast to the adiabatic mode, where the growing mode is the normal linear growth factor that we find for the total matter. And that means that the adiabatic mode quickly dominates over the isocurvature mode. And in fact, at current times, this ratio is 10 to the minus 2. So the isocurvature mode is highly suppressed. And if we're only concerned with computing the power spectrum at 1% order, we can neglect it in loops and only include it at linear level. And this turns out to be convenient because since we're neglecting isocurvature loops, the counter terms needed for these diagrams are not present. So we get a fewer number of parameters that describe this fluid. And that's due to the fact that the only effective pressure for both the dark matter and the baryons comes from the effective pressure of the total matter. And the isocurvature pressure is negligible. So this is a plot that demonstrates the isocurvature mode getting small. It's a plot of the baryon power spectrum over the dark matter power spectrum in a simulation that gravitationally couples the two, but includes no baryon effects of pressure or anything like that. So it's really just it's evolving the linear mode without the counter terms. So at early times, the baryons and the dark matter are order one different, but the baryons quickly become suppressed with respect to the dark matter. The baryons quickly follow the dark matter into dark matter wells and become follow the same evolution. So the isocurvature mode is small. Another difference of including two fluids in this approach is that there's a large effect on bulk flows. So for one fluid, we're not too concerned about bulk flows because if we compute equal time power spectra, then both perturbations move the same amount by the bulk mode, and it does not affect this correlation function. The only effect is through the width of the BAO peak, there's some smoothing of the oscillations. However, in the case of two fluids, the baryons and the dark matter have, in general, different velocities. So they're moved by different amounts, and this effect comes into all observables. You can think about this as the effect that the bulk mode can be thought of as a gauge artifact, where if you go to the center of mass frame, it's zero. And you can do this also in the adiabatic mode, but in that case, when you go to the center of mass frame, you still have the isocurvature velocity, which is a physical effect. A better way to treat bulk modes, so perturbation theory that we've been doing is done in Eulerian space, which is the normal fixed coordinates where you see the flow going by you. But it's also possible to do perturbation theory in Lagrangian space, where you track the displacement of the particles from their initial position q. So your dynamical variable is this displacement s. And since you're following the flow of the fluid, these bulk effects are automatically taken into account. And this is important because in the Eulerian approach, we're expanding in small displacements, assuming that they're small. Even though a linear displacement over a long period can create a large effect on the density by redistributing the particles. And you can see this by the fact that the displacement is the Fourier transform of the density. So it appears as in the exponent. And large displacements can produce large corrections to the density. So that means that we're potentially treating large displacements incorrectly in Eulerian theory. So we'll need to correct them using inspiration from the Lagrangian approach. And we do this by, we can resum the effect of the linear displacements by calculating what is the probability that we got to a certain point r from our initial Lagrangian point q. And in general, this probability is Gaussian-like around the initial point. And so the effect of these displacements is to sort of smooth out and redistribute the matter density. So the effect of this IRE summation can be included by convolving this probability convolving the probability distribution with our correlation function at point Q. And then we Fourier transform to get the power spectrum. So since this is a nonlinear effect, we have to correct each order of our Eulerian perturbation theory with an exponent that correctly cancels the remaining perturbative effects and up to the level of perturbation theory that we're concerned with. And in this way, we correctly expand around large displacements so that our remaining perturbation in terms of displacements is small rather than a naive large one. So we can also apply this approach to baryons, and the spirit is the same, but the effect with two fluids is much larger because the relative velocity of the baryons and the dark matter produces a large effect. So if baryons move a lot slower than the dark matter, then their distribution is a lot less peaked than you would expect in the cross correlation, because they aren't occupying the same area. So we expect a suppression in the matter power spectrum when we include the IRE summation. And we can test this by looking at the matter power spectrum at C equals 40, which is known to have a large isic curvature mode and leads to a breaking of perturbation theory even at one loop. So you have to resum the linear power spectrum. And so this was done by Selyakovich and Harada by just expanding around a constant velocity, and they found this suppression. And we calculated the same power spectrum with the effective field theory and get a similar suppression. But the advantage of our approach is that the order that we're neglecting is known, and we can calculate higher order. So if we wanted to go to higher loops, we could calculate it and get more accuracy and know that the IRV summation is also perturbative. Okay, so this is the full equation for our power spectrum of baryons and dark matter, and these are the Eulerian ones, but the ones I'll be plotting are IRV summed. So I've changed basis for the two speeds of sound into an adiabatic and an isocurvature speed of sound. And you can, although this C sub A is really one parameter, you can think of it as a term that comes from dark matter only fluid plus a perturbation proportional to the baryon density of the effect of baryons on the total matter speed of sound. So since this no baryon speed of sound is known from earlier work with dark matter only, we're going to plot this delta CA. So this can be measured by matching to simulation data of the power spectrum of the adiabatic modes divided by the power spectrum of the adiabatic modes with no baryons in the simulation. And similarly, the C sub I is the effect of pressure due to the fact that there are two different species. And this can be extracted by matching to the baryon power spectrum divided by the adiabatic one. So this is a plot of the no baryon power spectrum, the adiabatic power spectrum over the adiabatic dark matter only power spectrum, where these different colored dots are different simulations, which all include different baryon effects. So they have different levels of supernova feedback. Some include active galactic nuclei and some don't. So since it's not well known which effects are important, they simulated all different ones to see which had the biggest effect. And the solid lines are the EFT prediction. And you can see that we can match the simulations up to the error. And they all generally have the same k-dependence.
Sorry, question. Yep. So there's one free parameter that you fit to.
Mm-hmm.
That's this delta CA,
yeah,
square. Right? And that to different values of that one. So the other parameters, you already fixed them.
Well, the other parameter just doesn't come into this ratio.
Uh-huh. Okay. And then the different values give you different values.
Yeah. And so it's hard to see, but there's a theory error that kicks in near 0.7 from the fact that we're neglecting two contributions. And we've added a 1% systematic error. So we see that the EFT performs well up to k's of 0.7, which is consistent with the dark matter only approach. And for these different simulations, we get different values of C sum A, but they're all order one. They range between minus 0.3 and minus 3.
Did I understand the logic of those curves is that for each color curve, you're fitting to the same color points,
yeah,
using C, delta C A to.
Yeah.
It looks like the solid curves are always a little bit below the dots.
Yes, that's a good question. This was corrected in recently. This was also done in the dark matter approach that The fitting was done too far into the nonlinear regime, which results in this overfitting. So they've redone the plots and it has a slightly lower reach. This was done 8 months ago, so it hasn't been corrected, but that's right.
So you're saying there are some points that you're not plotting that this fits better? Is that, I
guess, how? No, I'm saying that the fitting was done sort of so it would best fit at high K.
K is the peak, because it seems that like the blue line at all K is below the points. So.
Yeah, exactly. But if you fit at a different momentum region, then you would boost the line up and not have them be systematically below the line. So this is just some details of the different simulations. And this is a plot of the total matter power spectrum of the EFT compared to the simulation. And all of these simulations have a very good agreement up to percent level, up to K of about 0.7. This is the same plot for determining C sub I. And similarly, we get order one values between minus 0.7 and minus 2. And this is a plot of the baryon power spectrum, which depends on C sub I. And it also has a good UV reach.
So do you have an interpretation why these are negative values of, I guess, delta C squared?
Yeah, I think because the baryons are pushed out by star formation processes, so it's a negative pressure.
Thank you. That's not negative. It would be nice to have it.
Well, it depends on what you define as a positive pressure. So just to summarize, we found that the CS parameters are order one, so this indicates that baryons are well approximated by the EFT. And we've seen that complicated baryon effects are captured in just one extra parameter with respect to the dark matter, and are given in a very simple functional form in terms of the total matter power spectrum. Moral of the story is, we want to improve large-scale structure constraints to potentially compare to the CMB. Baryons are an important part of matching to the data. And we've shown that the EFT consistently includes baryon effects. So that's it. RPT? There were previous.
RPT means renormalized perturbation theory?
Yeah. Or is this different than that?
RPT means improving the counterterms that you were talking about before?
Well, so they claim that improves the counterterms, but what they're really doing is a partial IRV summation. So there are previous effects. There was previous attempts to try to include counterterms, but they weren't done very consistently. So that's the advantage of the EFT approach, is that you know that you're doing everything.
And the problem with all these previous approaches they were trying to do is, I think, first principle. And I guess what's different here is that you don't. You say that these three parameters you can never
They assumed a perfect fluid up to arbitrary high scales. I'm not sure about this particular paper.
No, but I think it's, this came up, I think there was such a Murray's group who was doing something similar, and then Pat McDonald. And they were basically trying to do some sort of resummation of all the non-perturbative terms in CDM nonlinear, but they were not really including these, like, pressure terms as far as.
I think Pat thought he was improving on special Murray's, et cetera, but I think this. It's just like in QFT, like naive perturbation theory versus regardless. looks like, I agree, this looks like, my understanding is that this is a more systematic, better way of doing regular perturbation theory. And the question is there still room to argue and prove it? It reminds me that this business about the, that there was a best K at which to match.
Yeah.
We were talking a moment ago that,
yeah,
they found that they got a better fit for that.
Yeah, I mean, you have that same problem in quantum field theory. Like, if you're fitting for particle masses, so you have to fit a particular K, and then RG evolve into other Ks. But
right.
Yeah, it's possible that there's a better statistical method of determining which K to fit. But
have you thought about doing RG with this? Because I didn't see that.
Yeah. So the running of the CS couplings has been shown by taking small scale simulations of different box sizes. So.
You mean numerically?
Numerically, yes.
But you cannot calculate running the coupling constants. I don't know the way you do it.
Yeah, I mean you calculate the diagrams, you get a dependence on the cutoff, and that's the time dependence.
Can you go back to the slide where you had when you did your IRE summation, you were comparing your curve to someone else? Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
So in the other one, there's kind of the hump kind of went down, but in yours, there's like a two hump structure. What's going on there? Why do you have
that? I'm not sure, yeah, because theirs is not, it's not clear what level of approximation they're doing. I don't know if it's you can really do a one-to-one comparison, but yeah.
So where is the IR summation? I guess I missed it.
Oh, sorry.
You have a slide in IR summation. So what are the terms that you're resumming? Could you explain this a little bit?
So here, the probability distribution is sort of the Fourier transform of the exponential of the long displacement.
Mm-hmm.
So what it effectively does is it spreads around the particles rather than being in a specific place, because the displacements move them to slightly different places. And this just smooths out your correlation function.
All right.